Chapter 2 of Walter Youngquist's Geodestinies. Minerals Move People. The story of the importance of minerals in the rise and progress of civilizations are parallel stories. The search for and discovery of minerals from salt to gold and silver have caused mass migrations of people. Searching for minerals has been the cause of the opening of new lands. It has been said that, quote, the flag follows the miner's pick, unquote. The quest for gold and silver lured Spaniards to the New World, resulting in the conquests of Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and some of the adjacent lands. These movements continue to the present, with the rise of industrial civilization devouring mineral resources in huge quantities. Mineral resources, including energy, are the centerpiece of our existence. They are the basis for the good life, enjoyed by citizens of industrialized countries, and which others less fortunate hope to eventually enjoy. Migrations of people today to resource areas, or to nations that can import resources, are perhaps greater than at any time in the past. Seeking jobs and a higher standard of living, largely based on Earth's resources, people today are moving, both legally and illegally, by the millions. As a result of resource depletion caused by rising population, refugees, often with different birth rates, will markedly change the demographics of much of the world in this century. The fundamental causes of resource-related population migration and growth, such as land degradation and desertification, energy, water, and food demand, are the essential forces for monumental changes we will see this century. People are on the move. Salt and trade. Except for occasional travel by native peoples to certain localities to obtain chert or obsidian with which to make tools and weapons, probably the first mineral to cause people to travel substantial distances was common salt. No doubt, even before humans arrived on the Earth, animals traveled considerable distances to salt licks, just as they do today. Trails made by animals to salt licks in the eastern United States were some of the first trails the early settlers used. History records the caravans and traders who moved salt in ancient times over great distances. Some of these salt routes are still used in Africa. In the 6th century, salt was the chief item of trade for Venice, which developed a salt monopoly that extended over parts of the Mediterranean. Venetian salt traders traveled widely in their commerce. Gold seekers. Gold was the first metal used by humans, as it is bright and attractive in its native, pure form, in which it commonly occurs. It can easily be worked into many shapes and does not tarnish. Gold nuggets in stream beds attracted attention very early. This attraction for gold probably precedes humans, as pack rats and some birds will pick up small gold nuggets and put them in their nests. Silver is rarely found in native form, and it tarnishes easily. However, many silver ores can be smelted rapidly, so silver, too, has a long history of being sought by humans. It was put into use among earlier peoples, chiefly as ornaments, and later as coinage. Egypt. Gold was one of the earliest reasons for conquest and exploration. What is perhaps the first map ever made is a papyrus map of the Ramesside period in ancient Egypt that shows a route to the Koptos gold mines along the eastern border of Egypt next to the Red Sea. Egyptians took great quantities of gold from this area. The gold occurred as native gold in white quartz veins and in placers, sand and gravel deposits, downstream in the valleys below. But even richer gold deposits were in the upstream areas of the Nile, outside of Egypt in the Nubian desert. The name Nubian comes from the Egyptian word nub, which means gold. The Nubian gold lured the Egyptians to exploration and conquest of that area. The first gold was simply taken as plunder from the natives who already had it. Eventually, the pharaohs sent miners and established regular gold mining camps in Nubia. This pattern of exploration for gold plunder and later the establishment of permanent gold camps was repeated many times in history. Spanish conquests. It was said that the Spaniards had the gold disease, but the sad fact is that they had other diseases also, such as smallpox. Many of the native cultures that the Spaniards encountered were virtually destroyed by the contagious diseases that the gold and silver seekers brought with them. In that way, too, gold and silver altered the history of the native nations of the Western Hemisphere. Gold rushes. California. The 1849 gold rush to California is one of the great examples of migration caused by a mineral discovery. Ships went around Cape Horn and others went to Panama, where the passengers hiked across the Isthmus of Panama to meet another ship on the other side. Still others took the overland route to California. After the gold discovery of 1848, located about 40 miles from present-day Sacramento, by 1850, California's population reached 96,000 people. California was opened up by the discovery of gold, and it went on to become one of the great states of the United States, developing an economy of global significance. Australia. The discovery of gold in Australia opened up large areas of that continent that had previously been ignored. The early gold rushes to Victoria and New South Wales caused many changes in Australia. In 1850, there were only about 400,000 people in all of Australia. By 1861, so we're only talking 11 years later, there were more than a million. Melbourne got its start during the gold rush. Many of the fine gardens and some of the buildings, such as Government House, are legacies from what the discovery of gold did in the middle of the 19th century. For a while, Australia was the richest colony in the British Empire. Raymond, in his 1986 book, emphasized the importance of gold in fostering the migration of people in world trade. Quote, "The finding of gold in Australia, as in California, had a profound effect on the nation's economy, and would do so in other parts of the world where gold was soon to be discovered, New Zealand, South Africa, and Alaska. The gold rushes, wherever they occurred, brought new settlers, new ideas, new vigor, and created new wealth. Without the enormous amounts of gold that were produced in the latter half of the 19th century, the commerce of the modern world could never have reached the proportions that it has today. Only after the gold rushes was it possible to speak of something called world trade." Unquote. South Africa. The discovery of diamonds in South Africa in 1867 brought thousands of immigrants to that region. The subsequent discovery of many other important minerals, especially gold, led to the transformation of what was largely an agricultural economy in South Africa to the present-day urban industrial economy. The continuing international interest in South Africa over the years has stemmed largely from its possession of several strategic minerals, including 2/3 of the world's chromium and major deposits of platinum. Siberia. Siberia had no gold rush in the classic sense, but with a need for acceptable foreign change, the Russians over the years established gold camps and gradually moved people into the Kalyama gold province of Siberia. These camps have been expanded into permanent settlements, and now there are 12 cities in the region with a total population of about 500,000. Russia does not plan to allow these towns to be ghost towns when the gold is gone. There's lots of gold, so it will last for some time. But planners have gradually established manufacturing facilities there. In this way, they expect to keep the gold country settled permanently. Gold was simply the basis for moving people there initially and getting the settlements started. More recently, the Siberian city of Norilsk has been built 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle. Temperatures there reach minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and for 2 months, there is no sunlight. Minerals are the only reason for the city, which is situated on what is probably the richest ore body in the world. It contains an estimated 35% of the world's nickel, 10% of its copper, 14% of its cobalt, 55% of its palladium, and 20% of its platinum. The mine, even without additional discoveries, can continue to produce at the present rate for at least 40 years. The city will be home to the mine's 155,000 employees and their families far into the 21st century. Smaller gold rushes. To a modest degree, South Dakota, Colorado, and Georgia experienced gold rushes, which brought numbers of people into new territories. In South Dakota, it was a military expedition that first found gold in the Black Hills. With this discovery, the gold miners moved into what was then Native American territory, causing numerous bloody conflicts. In Colorado, an uninhabited broad upland valley in a few short months became Cripple Creek, which grew from a population of 15 people in 1891 to 50,000 people by 1900. Similar growth occurred in several other areas of Colorado where gold was discovered, such as Central City. The earliest discovery of gold in the United States appears to have been in North Carolina in 1799, when a boy found a shiny rock in a creek. But it was not recognized as gold until 1802, when a traveler jeweler saw it. By 1820, people from many parts of the world arrived, and at one mine, 13 languages were spoken. Most of those people stayed and contributed to the growing population of the state. In 1829, gold was discovered in what became the town of Dahlonega in northern Georgia, and a new gold rush was on. Some of the land involved was Cherokee Indian territory, but with the influx of gold miners, the demand for the land grew and ultimately the Cherokees lost out. In 1835, the Cherokees were forced to give up all their lands east of the Mississippi River and ordered to move westward along the Trail of Tears. However, about 14,000 refused to leave, and in 1838 were forced out militarily. Some 4,000 died during their expulsion. The cause of this displacement was the discovery of gold. Native Americans moved by minerals. Usually it was the trappers and miners who first came to the remote areas of the West rather than settlers, who were largely farmers. It was often the miners who became the first settlers on the land occupied by the Native Americans. The Sioux knew that there were gold deposits in the Black Hills and had shown specimens of it to Father Demet before Custer's soldiers found it in the French Creek. Although the area had been set aside by the government for the Native Americans, this was ignored when news of the gold discovery spread and miners flocked in. The initial discovery of gold in French Creek was on Native American land, which, by the terms of the Treaty of 1868, was off-limits to white settlement. But miners persisted, and when restrictions were lifted during the years of 1875 and 76, 11,000 miners entered the Black Hills. This invasion led the Sioux to resist and resulted in the famous Battle of the Little Bighorn, where General Custer and his men were massacred on June 25th, 1876. By September of that year, however, the Sioux were forced to sign a treaty giving up the Black Hills. Gold led to the expulsion of the Sioux. All across the West, Native Americans came into conflict with the miners and had to give up territory. This resulted in a great weakening of their economic and political positions and with destruction of what had been a sustainable, albeit primitive, way of life. Alaska and the Yukon. The Yukon and Alaska gold rush of 1897 and 1898 was the last great gold rush of the 19th century, but it had all the excitement and problems of previous gold rushes, and it, too, opened up virgin territory. It had its origin when two prospectors, Robert Henderson and George Carmack, were salmon fishing on the Klondike River, a tributary of the Yukon River in far northwestern Canada. These men saw the glint of gold in the stream bed late in the summer of 1896, but news of the discovery did not get out until 1897. The Klondike gold rush was then on. Dawson City grew from almost nothing to a population of 25,000 within a single year. By February 1898, 41 ships made regular runs between San Francisco and Skagway, Alaska, the port nearest the gold fields. From Skagway, the prospectors had to climb up and over Chilkoot Pass, or White Pass, to the Yukon. During the winter of 1897-1898, 22,000 people were checked through the border between Canada and the United States on these trail routes. The interior of Alaska was largely opened up by the discovery of gold. The town of Valdez, at the head of Prince William Sound, was a little fishing village until the Alaska Gold Rush started. Though it was not the shortest route to the gold fields, it was a route that did not cross into Canada and therefore avoided border inspection. 20,000 people flooded into Valdez. In a few years, the gold was mined out, and by the 1930s, the population fell to about 500. The population remained small until it was determined that the Trans-Alaska pipeline would terminate at Valdez, and once again, Valdez boomed. Now, with the steady work the pipeline terminal affords, the population of Valdez has settled to about 4,000. Thus, Valdez has seen two major bursts of population growth, one caused by gold and one by oil. And after oil? Fairbanks has had a history similar to that of Valdez. It got its start from the gold rush and then dwindled in population. But the oil discovery at Prudhoe Bay on the Beaufort Sea, 390 miles north of Fairbanks, brought a second boom time to Fairbanks. It was the logical place to build Prudhoe Bay support facilities, such as warehouses, and it is the halfway point on the Alaska pipeline. The population of Fairbanks doubled in 5 years. The northernmost road in North America ends at the northernmost and largest oil field in North America, Prudhoe Bay. The road now allows access to the region by the general public and has caused some minor migration. The oil pipeline maintenance and the beginning of the freight road to Prudhoe Bay and all that goes with that keeps Fairbanks busy. But as in the case of Valdez, what happens after oil? More recently, the discovery of microscopic gold in black shales, principally in Nevada, the so-called Carlin-type gold deposits, has caused a number of sizable communities to be established. Named the Silver State from the Comstock Lode and numerous other silver mines, Nevada is now the major gold producer in the United States, and silver mining has largely ceased. Several communities, such as Carlin and Battle Mountain, have expanded greatly because of adjacent gold mining operations. Silver. This metal, being much less valuable per ounce than gold, has generally not attracted nearly so much interest as gold. However, the discovery of the Comstock Lode and the many smaller subsequent silver strikes in western Nevada attracted many people into the state, including quite a few Welsh miners from Great Britain. They became known as Cousin Jacks, and a walk through the cemetery at Virginia City will show many tombstones noting the British origins of those who were buried there. The influx of population and the great wealth from the silver also was a major factor in moving Nevada into early statehood in 1864, compared with the adjacent states of Utah, 1896, and Arizona, 1912, and only 14 years later than California, 1850. Chinese and silver. In many mining areas of the West, significant numbers of Chinese arrived primarily to do menial tasks. They also had the patience to rework mine dumps left by the original miners. The Chinese generally were not accepted as part of the community, and so formed communities of their own, some literally underground. Remains of such communities are still in evidence beneath the streets of Pendleton, Oregon, and Idaho City, Idaho. As the mines gave out, some Chinese returned to China. Others stayed and established themselves in farming and various small businesses now scattered across the West. Northern Idaho. This is the site of what was at the time the largest silver mine in the United States. The Sunshine Mine produced silver for many years and caused the initial development of the Coeur d'Alene Mining District, where both lead and zinc in quantity were also found. Modern gold rushes. 20th century gold rushes include the black shale, Carlin-type Nevada developments, and a much bigger gold rush in Brazil, where tens of thousands of people in recent years have moved into the Amazon River Basin. Roads and airfields have been built in remote areas and towns established, where a short time ago there was only jungle. In addition to affecting the local area environmentally and impacting the social structure of the native populations, miners, who were once simply people scattered throughout Brazil, have now been brought together by gold to form a cohesive group, and have become at least a modest force in Brazil's political scene. The current Brazilian gold rush, however, was preceded several centuries earlier by the movement of people to Brazil, caused by the discovery of gold by the Portuguese, who first held colonial control of that country. They left the legacy of Portuguese as a national language. In 1862, gold was discovered in southeastern Brazil in a province which, because of its rich mineral resources, was named Minas Gerais, General Mines. For many years, the taxes imposed on Brazilian gold production kept the Portuguese treasury alive. But when the gold supplies declined, so did the economy of Portugal. Gold briefly made that nation rich, but Portugal has never since enjoyed such affluence. Somewhat smaller gold rushes, encouraging people to move into new areas, have recently occurred on the southern Philippine island of Mindanao, and also in New Guinea, where perhaps the largest single gold deposit now known in the world is located. In the relatively primitive wilderness of New Guinea, this event has had profound effects on the movement of people, with the construction of a large mining camp and supporting transport facilities in previously remote areas. Other mineral rushes. Canada and its Northland. With more than half the people of Canada living within 100 miles of the U.S. border, there are vast areas of this second largest nation in area in the world that are even today very sparsely inhabited. The northern regions are largely lakes, swamps, muskegs, bogs, flat low-lying tundra plains, and some slightly more upland areas with forests of small trees. Small ranges of hills occur in some parts, and some mountainous areas exist in northeastern, western, and northwestern Canada. The northernmost portion of mainland Canada is chiefly a featureless plain. Aside from limited hunting, trapping, and fishing, the only major economic resources are minerals and energy minerals. Hunting, fishing, and trapping did not provide an economic base to justify building roads, but minerals did. In Alberta, the northernmost road leads to the great Athabasca oil sands deposits near and beyond Fort McMurray, a city now almost entirely sustained by two large oil sands processing facilities. As the oil sands are more extensively developed, additional smaller communities have been established in this region. These areas can experience minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit temperatures at times and are beyond the economic limits of agriculture or forestry. The oil sands are the sole reason for the movement of people into this territory. In Saskatchewan, the two roads that go furthest north are those that end at the mines. The eastern one runs 269 miles to the Rabbit Lake uranium mine. The western road goes to the Key Lake and other uranium mines in the vicinity. This is one of the world's most important uranium mining districts, and it has opened up northern Saskatchewan and moved people there. In Manitoba, the North Country was opened up by the great nickel discoveries in the vicinities of the now thriving town of Thompson, with a population more than 20,000. The road going to the farthest north from there leads to the Lynn Lake mining district of northwestern Manitoba. More recently, diamonds of excellent quality have been discovered at several localities in northern Manitoba, with adjacent small communities established. In Ontario, the great gold mines at Timmins, which once were the world's largest producers, brought people and large towns to that area, forming a complex of communities today with more than 50,000 people. In Quebec, the northernmost road makes a big loop, and at the top of the loop are the gold mines of the Chibougamau area. Gold was the reason the road was built and is now maintained. Along the Quebec-Labrador border, tremendous iron ore deposits are the only reason for Labrador City and the road and railroad to that area. Oil. The opening up and development of new lands by the oil industry is also a cause for the movement of people. In the northern Satura Desert of Peru, the town of Talahara, with several thousand inhabitants, exists solely because of the oil industry. It rains only once every several years or less. Without the oil field, there would be little basis for settlement except perhaps as a subsistence fishing village that existed before oil. The now thriving city of Maracaibo, Venezuela, located near the southeast end of the semi-desert Guarija Peninsula, is there only because of the rich oil deposits in the Maracaibo Basin. Editor's note, I apologize if I'm butchering up these names. The 1859 oil discovery in the United States by Colonel Drake, assumed title, he was actually a railroad conductor, near Titusville, Pennsylvania, brought a 59er rush. Some 30,000 people almost immediately moved into the area and then spread out to other areas to search for more oil. Oil in the Persian Gulf created work opportunities that brought tens of thousands of people to the region. Indians, Pakistanis, Filipinos, Palestinians, and Egyptians were among the major groups represented. When the 1991 Gulf War broke out, more than half the people living in Kuwait were foreigners. Today, in Dubai, of the United Arab Emirates, the population is only 15% native. Neighboring Qatar sits atop the world's largest single natural gas deposit, 12% of proved world reserves, and has oil exports that give it a per capita income of $13,600 a year. This robust economy has attracted Indians, Pakistanis, Iranians, and Palestinians to the extent that they make up more than two-thirds of Qatar's current population of about 700,000. Qatar is a desert peninsula, with an annual rainfall of only about 2.5 inches. For centuries, fishing was the principal occupation of the relatively few inhabitants of the region, who led a subsistence existence. Petroleum made profound changes and caused a large migration of people to the country. Ghost towns, and some that survive. Just as minerals move people into areas, exhaustion of these deposits may cause an outward migration. Many ghost towns in western United States, as well as in other parts of the world, are grim testimony to the fact that minerals are a one-crop resource. The complete economic cycle is the discovery, development, and then decline and exhaustion of the one-time mineral crop. People move into developing mineral resource areas. Then, as the mineral base gradually declines, people move out. There are examples of this in partially abandoned mining towns and the decline of once rich oil-producing areas. This can be seen even now in parts of the one-time oil-producing giant Texas. However, in some instances, once people have come to an area because of its mineral wealth, they find other ways to survive after the minerals are gone. Some areas become farming or ranching communities. Others become tourist attractions like Virginia City, site of the once fabulously rich silver Comstock lode in Nevada. And some have become gambling communities like Cripple Creek and Central City in Colorado. Kellogg, Idaho grew because of the Sunshine Silver Mine. The mine is closed and Kellogg has tried to transform itself into a tourist destination, in part by developing a small skiing facility. Fertile topsoil. Gold rushes are a strikingly visible demonstration of how minerals move people and make for romantic history. Far more people have moved because of the availability of new lands with fertile topsoil to cultivate. Unlike the one-crop minerals and energy minerals, properly managed soil brings a crop year after year, so people move in and stay. In North America, Canada and the United States were widely settled first by farmers, after which came migration to the cities and the large development of cities today. The rich lands of South Africa, the pampas of Argentina, and the wheat-growing plains of Australia also encouraged mass migrations of people. In the case of the United States, the Homestead Act, which granted tracts of public land to settlers who would first claim and then farm the land, moved people westward. On at least one occasion, this was a rather dramatic movement, when lands in Oklahoma were about to be released for settlement. There was a fixed opening date and a firm boundary behind which people were to assemble, and at signal to go in and claim land parcels. But some people did not wait and sneaked into the territories offered before the opening date. They arrived sooner, and thus the nickname for Oklahoma as the Sooner State. Railroads were granted lands, usually alternative sections, a square mile, in a strip 10 miles wide along each side of the tracks to encourage the building of railroads. Once built, the railroads advertised free lands and were eager to move people to them, so the railroads could generate businesses by hauling settlers and their goods west and agricultural products east. Availability of rich, fertile land was the prime motivation. A similar situation existed in Canada and resulted in the settlement of the last large agricultural area of the world, the southern portions of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. Possibly the last mineral to significantly move people in the United States is the oil in the Bakken Formation in the Williston Basin of North Dakota. People from all across the United States moved to Williston to work in the development of the Bakken Field and all the supporting facilities. Building housing for the inflow of population could not meet demand, forcing people to sleep in their trucks. When the oil is gone, North Dakota will likely return to its agrarian economy, perhaps symbolic of all economies, when the exploitation of non-renewable earth resources ends and industrial societies must revert to agrarian economies. Move to the cities. Even as the rich, fertile land resource initially brought immigrants to North America and to other places such as the Pampas of Argentina, energy resources have since moved much of the population off the farms and into cities. Today, with the use of petroleum-powered farm machinery, only about 2% of America's population farms the land, where 100 years ago the majority of people did. But energy slaves, cheaply oil, now do the farm work, causing another great migration of people to the industrial areas, which in turn exist because of abundant energy to run factories. This has also been true in Europe and is now taking place in China and Southeast Asia. Mineral and energy resources have caused and continue to cause great human migration, both within countries and across international boundaries. The continued invasion of North America. In a broad sense, the migration to North America was caused by the availability of fertile lands and other mineral resources. As they were discovered and developed, they produced an ever higher standard of living, luring more people to come. This attraction continues. Currently, the United States annually takes in more legal and illegal immigrants than all of the rest of the world combined. The natural resources that are still available in the United States, together with those that can now be imported, provide the basis for the standard of living envied and sought by much of the rest of the world. Haiti. The persistent attempts by Haitians to enter the United States are resource-based. Haiti, which occupies the western third of the island of Hispaniola in the Caribbean, has an area of about 10,500 square miles. It has no oil, gas, coal, water power, or any other appreciable mineral resources. When one flies into the capital, Port-au-Prince, there is a noticeably brown ring in the ocean shore area where rivers are depositing silt and clay from continually eroding hilly and mountainous regions that make up most of Haiti. What little fertile soil remains continues to be lost at a disastrous rate. More than 10 million people crowd Haiti's limited area. Once almost entirely wooded, Haiti is now nearly treeless. People are digging up roots for fuel. The contrast of this situation to the abundance of resources available to citizens of the United States is enormous. As a result, Haitians have an overwhelming desire to migrate to a land that has resource wealth sufficient to provide even its lowest economic segment a better standard of living than the average Haitian has. With Haiti's population growth of about 2.8% annually, one of the highest in the Western Hemisphere, the problem will only intensify. At that rate, the population will double in about 25 years, which can become an absolute disaster. Supplying more and more imported food to such a situation with no attention to population control simply treats the symptoms and not the cause, ensuring even greater problems in the future. Some reasonable relationship between population and the resource base a country has or can import must be established, Otherwise, people will either starve or depend on permanent international welfare. To continue to export population cannot be the ultimate solution. Fewer and fewer countries are now willing or ultimately able to continue to be a safety valve for migrating populations. Japan accepts virtually no immigrants, and Sweden, for the first time, has been turning some away. Germany has been expelling foreign nationals. Resources to house and feed the immigrant flood is a critical factor. Editor's note, this was written long before the migrations, the Syrian refugees and all that we're seeing now in 2015 and early 2016. Increasing urge to migrate. With rapidly growing populations and mineral resources becoming more costly as the higher quality and easily accessible sources are exhausted, problems of resource access and distribution will grow. The pressure for populations to migrate to areas which still have resources available will increase. By both legal and illegal means, mass migrations of people will continue and are already a problem that has the potential of great social unrest. This is already happening. In 1995, the decision by President Clinton to return all Cuban refugees to Cuba led to riots in Miami. Riots and demonstrations in Los Angeles have also had an immigrant origin. The problem of refugees is not decreasing. What is decreasing is the willingness of many countries to accept more refugees. In contrast, the United States now has a liberal immigration policy, allowing over 1 million newcomers in each year. It also has a relatively porous border, which lets in another estimated 500,000 or more illegal immigrants. The result is that some states are beginning to resist this burden. In 2004, one country in Idaho sent Mexico a bill for $545,000 for health and welfare care of illegal immigrants in the previous year. So far, they have received no reply, and the county residents are stuck paying the bill. Because of the impact of illegal immigrants upon their resources, the states of California, Texas, and Florida filed lawsuits against the U.S. government in 1994. The suit asserts that lack of enforcement of federal immigration laws resulted in an intolerable drain of resources from the states. In California, all the recent growth of that state has been due to foreign immigration. To accommodate the increase in children, in 1995, one new schoolroom had to be built each hour and one new school each day. In 1994, California passed Proposition 187, denying illegal immigrants a variety of services, including schooling. This caused numerous protests and demonstrations, but the immigration, which accounts for almost 100% of the state's population growth, continues. California, which had a 75% increase in population since 1970, now has 38 million residents and expects to have a population swelling to 58 million by 2040. California is now the fourth largest consumer of oil in the world, behind the United States as a whole, China, and Japan. Water is becoming critically scarce in some areas of the region, with Imperial Valley agricultural irrigation water from the Colorado River being sold to the cities. California's resource base is already strained. How will the additional 20 million people expected by 2040 be supported? This prospect must be squarely faced, because most people living in California today will see that increase and its accompanying demand on resources. The high physical standard of living in the United States, which attracts immigrants, legal and illegal, is based on availability of earth resources. To maintain that standard of living each year, each person in the United States must be provided with some 20 tons of mineral resources. As more and more people enter the country by birth or illegal immigration, 20 additional tons of minerals must annually, not just once, but every year, be provided for each individual. As the United States becomes more and more dependent on importing these resources, the balance of international payments problems grows. Being able to supply resources to immigrants is what draws them. But at some point, this in turn will adversely affect the future of the United States if the balance of payments problem will no longer allow increased resources to be imported. the much-valued U.S. standard of living will fall, and its destiny will be altered. A nation that does not control its borders loses its sovereignty and control of its economic future. In a study of why people migrate, Hal Kane has observed, quote, "Water tables will continue to be drawn down far faster than they can replenish themselves in many countries. Soils will continue to erode, and more people will react to these pressures in the future by leaving their homes," unquote. Describing Ethiopia, with a present population of 57 million, he states, quote, "The nation faces a colossal increase of 106 million during the next 40 years based on current growth rates. It is almost impossible to imagine how Ethiopia could possibly feed so many more people. It has some of the world's most severely eroded soils, much of its cropland is on steep slopes, and its tree cover stands at a mere 3%. Many of Ethiopia's next generation will probably have to choose between emigration and starvation," unquote. Kane calls the tendency of people to migrate the push of poverty, the pull of wealth. He concludes that a major and increasing cause of human migration is the exhaustion of natural resources. Quote, "Many countries, particularly in Africa, but increasingly elsewhere as well, have been living off their capital, consuming their foreign reserves, their forests, their soils, and freshwater aquifers. As these reserves are diminished, pressures and conflicts mount, and some people are forced to flee. The number of people on the move today has reached its highest point in history. But if nations do not shift spending priorities from military security to investments in the long-term environmental and social health of their citizens, these numbers may be dwarfed by the tide yet to come," unquote. The end of the physical frontier. Today, there are no large, unoccupied, resource-rich areas to absorb migration. There are no vacant, fertile, well-watered lands. During the last 500 years, the major waves of human population have generally migrated westward. When the final big wave hit the Pacific shores of North and South America, beyond lay Asia and India with their teeming billions. The circle was complete. The globe filled up. New lands with untouched resources were no more. With no new geographic frontiers in which to expand, today's nations jostle for position within the well-populated and fully explored world. The competition through migration and perhaps military conflict will increasingly be over access to Earth's remaining resources of energy, water, fertile soil, and other minerals. Making rational and successful adjustments between population and resources will determine the destiny of the human race. I'm going to read that again. Making rational and successful adjustments between population and resources will determine the destiny of the human race. Populations must recognize that this destiny is by geology imposed upon them. There must be a recognition of natural limits. Continued growth of population compounds problems that must be faced sooner or later, and the sooner the better. Globalization of carrying capacity problems. Because resources and population are unevenly distributed, the current trend is for people to move from distressed areas to areas that have more resources, or for wealthier nations to send basic resources to the impoverished regions. Such aid does not solve the basic problem and may only make it worse if it allows more people to survive temporarily on a land already overpopulated for its resources. If emigration from distressed areas to areas that still have resources continues, without eventually stabilizing human population, will there ultimately be worldwide prosperity or a worldwide slum? Garrett Hardin considers this matter. Quote, "The production of human beings is the result of very localized human actions. Corrective action must also be local. Globalizing the population problem would only ensure that it is never solved." Hardin adds, quote, "Some social experiments have had very bad outcomes indeed. The wisdom is very old. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Given many sovereign nations, it is possible for humanity to carry out many experiments in population control. Each nation can observe the success and failures of the others. Experiments that have a good outcome can be copied and perhaps improved upon. Unsuccessful experiments can be noted and not repeated. Such learning by trial and error is perilous if the borderless world created by unrestricted migration converts the entire globe into a single huge experiment, unquote. The lifeboat ethics concept. Hardin's observations are a facet of his lifeboat ethics. A ship is sinking, and there is one lifeboat. It is launched and filled to its stated capacity for 50 people, but there are still 100 people in the water. Do you, in the spirit of fairness for everyone, take on the additional 100 from the water and have everyone drown? Or do you preserve the one lifeboat and its passengers so that they can get to the far shore and survive? Do you convert the entire world to a giant slum by unrestricted immigration and no population control? Or do you restrict immigration and insist that individual nations do something about population so that at least some of them who are successful survive? At present, a number of nations are trying to export their population problems, which ultimately will, if not checked, become a global disaster. However, it will have the merit of equality. Poverty will be universal. Continued population migration will make this concept of lifeboat ethics a serious consideration. Responsible and firm action may be required to prevent lifeboat nations, quote-unquote, from being swamped and sunk. Lucas and Ogletree relate this problem to world hunger. Pimentel and Giampetro have amplified lifeboat role for the United States in their statement, quote, "Self-sufficiency in food production and other basic resources should be viewed as a strategy to guarantee a continued high standard of living and national security to U.S. citizens in the face of turbulence that can be expected around the world in the next decades. There is no time for delay. Choosing not to change the current pattern of high immigration and rapid population growth means moving into the Malthusian trap in the United States," unquote. Immigration today. Immigration can be both detrimental and beneficial to a country. However, overwhelming massive immigration, legal or illegal, dilutes available resources with an accompanying reduction in physical standard of living. It also negatively impacts the environment. The primary motivation for people to move from poorer nations to more affluent ones is usually pressure from population growth that requires limited local resources to be divided among more and more people, reducing the standard of living for all. Migration to another country with more current resources per capita simply brings the resource problem with each immigrant. Worldwide, family planning in all nations and at least population stabilization is the front line of attack on the problem of mass migrations of people. It will determine what standard of living we ourselves, our children, and our grandchildren will have in the future. And this future is arriving at the rate of more than 200,000 people every day.